Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated December 2nd, 2019. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, Like a Family, Powell Set to Step Down as Art Council Gallery Director. From Decatur, December is a busy time for Sue Powell and the staff at the Decatur Area Arts Council. But that isn't stopping the current gallery director from retiring. Powell said the time was appropriate for her stepping down, but she will miss the people she works with. It's like a family. We are a team, she said. We work hard and we laugh hard. The Arts Council will say goodbye to its gallery director during a special DAAC retirement party on Monday, December 16th, on the third floor of the Madden Arts Center. Powell's husband, Gary, retired more than a year ago. He is ready for me to go with him, Powell said about the future of retirement plans. As excited as she is to leave her job, this isn't her first time attempting retirement. Powell spent 25 years as the supervisor of cultural arts with the Decatur Park District. So, I've retired once already, she said. Powell graduated with a degree in art education in 1975 from the University of Illinois. She taught in Arkansas and Alabama before moving to Decatur with her first husband, but there were no art teaching positions, she said. That's when I went to the Park District. Powell decided to stay in central Illinois after her first husband left. This had become my community, she said. It turned out to be a great place to live and to work, and it has a supportive community. During her time with the Park District, Powell also served on the DAAC board for 8 years. At the time of her first retirement in 2003, the board was in the process of renovating the current Arts Council building located at 125 North Water Street. It was the most beautiful segue because they needed a program director for the Arts Council, she said. Powell said she feels lucky to be a part of the DAAC. It is a huge team effort, she said. Programming for the Arts Council brought her back to her visual arts roots. The Park District work allowed her opportunities to work with performing artists, which translated to her next job as the gallery director. It was kind of like another stage for presenting the arts, she said. It was fun to figure out how to put the artwork up to its best advantage, to really show off what was special about that artwork. Powell was also able to work with various artists during her career. The opportunities to focus on a multitude of genres was important to the gallery director. Music, dance, culinary arts, poetry, theater, and other arts were incorporated into events or highlighted on their own. We are trying to really provide a broad range of exposure to the arts, to the community, Powell said. Arts Council Executive Director Jerry Johnson has worked alongside Powell since 2011 on a variety of community projects, including theater productions. I have directed her on stage, as well as working backstage and performing with her, Johnson said. We have joked that over the years, we've been in shows together where she has played my girlfriend, my wife, and even my mom. Along with her creativity and knowledge, Powell brought her experience to the Arts Council. She knows everybody in the Decatur arts community, Powell said. Powell's replacement as gallery director is Decatur native Jamie Fawley. We are lucky to have her join our team too, Johnson said. With Sue's retirement, along with Stella Carnahan's retirement a few years ago, the Arts Council is entering a new phase. Those who established the organization downtown have handed things off, and we are planning and preparing for the future. Powell isn't worried either. She said she has confidence in the future gallery director. The girls got it, Powell said. The two have experience working together. Fawley worked as a DAAC art teacher for about 5 years. Powell and Fawley also worked together at the Park District as well as through BOSS, the Park District's Summer Children's Theatrical Program. She is a great person to learn from, said Folly, 47. The gallery directors have been working and training together for months, preparing for the transition. There's no manual on how things are done, Folly said. I'm going to hate to see her go. When she first arrived in the area, Powell researched the DAAC. That was in the relatively early years, she said. They had only been incorporated about 10 years at that point. Since she was an art teacher, Powell wanted to learn more about the arts community she lived in. And they embraced me, she said. Little did I know I would be on the board for 8 years and be on the staff for 16 years. It's been a long relationship. The growth of the Arts Council has expanded across the city. The establishment began in a small house. Then it moved to Rock Springs Conservation Area before relocating to a small building on North Main Street. The Arts Council moved to its current location in downtown Decatur in July 2004. From the time we opened the doors, the community embraced it, Powell said. People have stayed involved in it. The building has been used for various events, such as dinner theaters, jazz performances, and improv shows. That has really been exciting to see how a community arts center could be used, Powell said. To be part of the ground floor, Powell said, was an amazing experience. So they can't get rid of me that easily, she said. I am a member of the community, so I would like to enjoy what is being offered. Decatur is an artsy place. It just doesn't know that. And the sidebar, If You Go, says, the Decatur Area Arts Council Retirement Party. When? 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. on Monday, December 16th. Where? On the third floor of Madden Arts Center, 125 North Water Street, in Decatur. And the cost? It's free. And this article was part of the Together Decatur series. If you know a person or a story that exemplifies the best of Decatur, contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. And continuing on the front page, Financial Disclosure Ethics in Spotlight. From Springfield, a bribery charge against a state legislator and federal investigations into lobbying have Illinois lawmakers promising to tighten the rules of soliciting and exercising influence in the statehouse, with a renewed focus on the ridiculed process of financial disclosure. The General Assembly wrapped up its fall session by adopting legislation to streamline information about lobbying, government contracts, and campaign contributions, but delayed examining fiscal reporting requirements of legislators and other state policymakers. More than 26,000 state employees must annually file a statement of economic interest, comprising 8 questions designed to identify financial involvement that could intersect with state business. Often mocked as none sheets for the answers they have habitually produced, critics say the process falls short. For example, it requires disclosing monetary gains without identifying the transactions that yielded them. It compels identifying lobbyists with whom the filer has a close economic relationship, but provides no definition. The narrowly tailored questions seem to provide plenty of opportunity to shield relationships, say, by routing funds through an intermediary, said Jay Young, Executive Director of Common Cause, Illinois. The statements reemerged as an issue with the federal bribery charge against former Chicago Democrat Representative Luis Arroyo, who allegedly tried to buy a senator's support for legislation on an issue about which he was simultaneously lobbying Chicago city officials. Other federal inquiries have spotlighted lobbyists, such as in subpoenas for information from Exelon, parent company of power giant ComEd. House Majority Leader Greg Harris's measure was accompanied by a resolution creating a commission to examine ethics challenges facing the ethics-challenged politics of Illinois, including an improved disclosure statement, and recommend changes by next spring. Disclosure centers on ownership or investments valued at more than $5,000 or which yielded more than $1,200 in the preceding year, whether it be owning a company doing business with the state, a filer's profession outside of the job for which disclosure is required, any organization which pays the filer as an officer or partner, and investments or real estate yielding capital gains. There is the question about relationships to lobbyists, and one about gifts totaling more than $500. Harris's legislation included a revamped statement, but House members of both parties objected to adopting a replacement without more discussion. It attempted to garner better detail by requiring reporting of any asset worth more than $5,000, which the filer held at the end of the previous filing period. Kathy Jackson, Director of Legal Services for McLean, Virginia-based Financial Disclosure Resources, which specializes in assisting federal judges in their financial reporting, noted that, like in the current form, the question recognizes assets from a snapshot in time, but doesn't reveal the source of those assets or resulting dividend. If someone makes a purchase at a favored rate, that could be invisible to the public because neither purchase values nor the subsequent values of individual holdings would be reportable, Jackson said. And while a favored rate might ultimately be defined as a reportable gift, that language is not included in the current iteration. And while the proposed changes also would require reporting assets held jointly with a spouse or with minor children, Jackson pointed out that it's not unusual for assets to be put solely in a child's name. The change also would simplify the lobbyist question to requiring identifying any economic relationship along with family members who lobby. By the same token, Representative Keith Wheeler stressed the questions and their answers should be understandable and provide information pertinent to the job. The Oswego Republican said GOP members balked at adopting a new form this month because of concerns about interpreting some questions and to ensure protection of clients' names and other matters of professional confidentiality. For some critics, the missing key to ensuring ethics among decision-making is not related to the disclosure process. It's an absent conflict of interest law. Illinois' Governmental Ethics Act provides principles for legislators, but they're guidelines as opposed to rules enforced by discipline, said Elisa Kaplan, Policy Director for Reform for Illinois. It's routine for a lawmaker to announce before a floor vote that while she or he has a conflict of interest on the issue, I will be voting my conscience. And continuing on the state and local page, Santa would live here. Old St. Nick's Country Retreat turns out to be Allerton House. Tony Reed writes from Monticello. If you had to imagine a modest country retreat for Santa Claus, it would be hard to come up with anything more appropriate than the festive riot of red brick known as Allerton House in Monticello. Gifted to the University of Illinois by art lover and philanthropist Robert Henry Allerton as the ultimate Christmas present, the 120-year-old 40-room mansion is built for entertaining. And Sunday found the right jolly old elf in residence, care of the Sweets with Santa event, sponsored by an investment from the State Bank of Bement. Clutches of wide-eyed visitors sought out the man in red as he reclined regally in a throne-like chair upstairs above a long, spacious entertainment area known as the gallery. Children, many clutching painstakingly handwritten lists, lined up to whisper the contents of their heart's desires and get a coveted picture with old St. Nick. Back downstairs, Mrs. Claus sat in front of a giant fireplace in the mansion's exotic wood-paneled two-story library to read Clement Clark Moore's A Visit from St. Nicholas. But in this heavenly version of Father Christmas's house, there were many mansion rooms containing many more delights as well, including festive games, cookie decorating, holiday card creation, and even a movie room where tired elves and their parents could rest up for a bit. Allerton House event coordinator Ashley Sims said Sweets with Santa has been staged for the last 5 years and has become one of the most popular kid-themed activities. "We have over 500 people coming through the door today," she added. "Tickets went on sale in October and sold out more than a month ago. This house makes it easy to stage events like this, and, well, it's the magic of Allerton. You just know Santa would live here." Above stairs, meanwhile, the big man himself, a.k.a. Wendell Brock, was deftly fielding requests from children who insisted they had been good and anything he had heard to the contrary was a downright lie. Oh my, some of the requests I receive that always get Mom and Dad are when children, out of a clear blue sky, ask for baby brothers and sisters, said Brock. But I've also been asked for chainsaws, all kinds of things. In quiet moments alone, Mrs. Claus, a.k.a. Judy Lockman, said her mom used to read her The Night Before Christmas classic when Lockman was a little girl, but would put a twist in the poem that would take her grown-up daughters years to get over before she could keep a straight face and read it out loud to kids herself. My mom would read the line, "Tore open the shutters and threw up the sash," and add, "I don't know why he swallowed the sash in the first place," she recalled with a wicked smile. And this article is accompanied by pictures, one of Santa Claus with two little children dressed in red and green fancy sweaters. 2-year-old Bridget Biswell of Monticello discusses Christmas gift-giving prospects with Santa, a.k.a. Wendell Brock, as big brother Brandon, 4, awaits the moment when they get handed candy canes. The Sweets with Santa event at Allerton House drew more than 500 visitors on Sunday. There's also a photograph of Mrs. Claus reading to several children in front of the giant fireplace and large lit Christmas tree. And next from Decatur, deer harvest numbers drop in first weekend of hunting. Preliminary numbers showed the deer harvest was down around 15% from last year for the first weekend of the firearm deer season, according to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. A total of 50,173 deer were harvested from November 22nd to November 24th, down from a 3-day total of 58,836 in 2018. The state's 7-day firearm season wraps up December 5th through the 8th. In Macon County, the haul decreased slightly from 152 last year to 149. Most surrounding counties saw even larger decreases. Christian County, 475 to 372. DeWitt County, 244 to 206. Moultrie County, 179 to 156, Piatt County 85 to 83, Sangamon County 419 to 329, and Shelby County 837 to 757. Muzzle loader only deer season goes from December 13th to the 15th. Archery season continues through January 19th, with a pause from December 5th through the 8th. For the firearm season. Late winter antlerless only chronic wasting disease seasons go from December 26th to the 29th and January 17th through the 19th. And from the Life page, Dear Abby, woman reluctant to be open about religion. Dear Abby, I am a woman in my 30s with a good head on my shoulders, but I have a dilemma. I recently became Wiccan, and I'm hiding my new religion from my fiancé. I was raised Protestant, but have drifted away from Christianity. My fiancé was raised Catholic, but no longer practices. He's not actively involved in any religion, but I'm worried about how he will react to learning that I'm now a witch, which is just a broad term for anyone who follows the Wiccan spiritual path. I don't want him to think I've lost my mind, but I also can't keep hiding my beliefs from him. Secrets are never a positive thing in a relationship, but I'm worried about how this news will be received. Please help. From West Virginia Wiccan. Dear Wiccan, I agree this isn't a secret you should keep. If it were me, I would start disclosing the information slowly, sharing Wiccan literature, telling him I found it fascinating, and sharing a few of the principles with him. Refrain from hitting him over the head with an announcement of your conversion, and it will be less shocking. Next, dear Abby, I have a new boss. He is a very nice man. With the Christmas season approaching, how do I communicate to him that I do not want to exchange gifts? I don't want him to feel obligated to give me anything. It may be presumptuous of me to think he may want to. I believe this is his first supervisory position and he may not even think about gifts. We have very little contact. I have been the receptionist for our building for many years and do not require much supervision. We are in different parts of the building, and he stops by occasionally to see how I'm doing. My previous boss, a woman I reported to for many years, and I would exchange gifts because we were friends. Signed, Cordial in Texas. Dear Cordial, I do not recommend mentioning gifts to your new boss. It is entirely possible that he won't be gifting you anything this Christmas. However, on the chance that he might, keep a little something in your desk drawer just in case. A small, prepackaged fruitcake might be nice. You can always use it as a doorstop or a hockey puck if he doesn't drop by with a gift in hand. And next, dear Abby, why do women stop having sex after marriage? This is my second marriage. We have been married 2 years, and to date, we have had sex 3 times. Before marriage, we had a great sex life, but the day I said I do, it stopped. I'm not the only man who is faced with this problem. Signed, Need an Answer. Dear Need, something is wrong with this picture. Not all women stop having sex after marriage. The two of you are long overdue for a frank conversation because this isn't fair to you. Could your wife's lack of interest be medical or emotional? Do you get along otherwise? Did this happen with your first wife, too? If the answer to that question is yes, your technique may need some polishing, or your wives may not have enjoyed sex before or after your weddings. And from the parenting advice column, talking about school shootings, how to approach difficult subject with your children. The recent shooting at Saugus High School in Santa Clarita touched off intense, heart-sinking fear among many teenagers who ran for cover, barricaded classroom doors with tables and chairs, and hid in closets. Later, as they were reunited at a park, evacuated students and parents collapsed into one another's arms in long, tearful hugs. Fear made it feel like we were waiting in silence forever, said Andre Mojica, 17, who locked down with his AP government classmates and prepared to use a fire extinguisher as a weapon if needed. How do we recover and step forward past this incident? Mojica asked. There are some suggestions from the National Association of School Psychologists and other mental health experts on how to do just that. Number 1, check in with your child. The first thing adults should do is make sure their child or adolescent knows they are willing and available to talk with them, said Stephen Brock, a professor of school psychology at Cal State Sacramento in California. Help them process whatever they want, Brock said. At the same time, especially in the immediate aftermath of an incident like this, it's important not to force the issue. You simply acknowledge the event. Ask them if they have questions, he said, and let their questions be your guide. Number two, give kids reassuring facts. Parents should immediately reassure children that they are safe. With younger children, adults can draw attention to all that adults do to keep them safe, such as locking doors and conducting emergency drills. Parents also can and should tell their children that school is a safe place for them. It's an objective fact. It's reality, Brock said, citing national data that show physical fights, violence, and weapons incidents are all down in schools since the early 1990s. Today, these words and these statistics may ring hollow because we just had a terrible tragedy, but pretty much 99% of 5 to 18-year-olds that are homicide victims die away from school, Brock said. Number three, treat children according to their age. Younger kids may not be as worried, but teenagers are likely to know more and have concerns, so it's better to address the subject directly with them rather than avoid it, said Carol Vidal, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University. The most important thing is not to minimize any sense of anxiety that they may have, Vidal said. Give young children only brief, simple information. These children are less verbal, so they may communicate about their anxiety by drawing or playing, Vidal said. Answer their questions with specifics, but don't overload them. For middle and high school age youth, more detailed conversations will be appropriate. The best place to have that conversation depends on the teen. It could be in the car or while a friend is present, instead of just sitting and talking about the event one-on-one. Number four, limit exposure. This is true for youth of all ages. Violent images can cause secondary trauma, and developmentally inappropriate information can cause anxiety and confusion. Prolonged exposure to graphic images and details is harmful to them as well. Social media doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, Vidal said, citing example of the students affected by the 2018 shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. You can use it to activate people in political matters and do events to help them socialize with other people. It can give them a purpose, she said. Number five, have a plan. Review safety procedures at school and at home. Let children know whom to call, where to meet, and how to communicate in case of an emergency. This helps children feel secure and know adults are in control. Number six, model healthy behavior. Parents can set an example by turning off the television, radio, or social media. It can be constructive for parents to acknowledge that constantly watching or hearing about a violent incident makes them, too, feel anxious or fearful. But parents should make clear that they are handling their own emotions and their child does not need to be strong for them, said Jonathan Vicberg, a licensed marriage and family therapist who treats kids dealing with trauma. We can model that we can feel dysregulated at times, too. But it's not for kids to take care of parents, Vicberg said. Number seven, maintain routines. Sticking to regular routines can be reassuring and can help children and teens maintain a sense of normality. What happens after any traumatic event is it feels like our lives are going to be disrupted forever, Vicberg said. Routine can help us feel regulated again, whether it's an adult or a kid. With teenagers in particular, giving them extra time to be with friends is important. It helps them establish normality and connect to their support network. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, December 2nd, 2019. Please stay tuned.